Hey, everybody, it's Mike from the Mike Wagner Show, powered by SonicWeb Studios. Visit online at sonicwebstudios.com for all your needs. Looking at a professional website without breaking your budget? SonicWeb Studios is the answer. SonicWeb Studios offers fast, affordable custom web designs that blow the competition away. Call today, 1-800-303-3960. That's 1-800-303-3960. Or email to support at sonicwebstudios.com. Mention the Mike Wagner Show, get 20% off your first project. SonicWeb Studios, take your image to the next level. Also, time to give official shout out to our official sponsor of the Mike Wagner Show, international award-winning author Mia Molson-Zia. If you love fast-paced mysteries, you'll love Missing by Mia Molson-Zia, available on Amazon and paperback and ebook. Missing is fast-paced and intriguing with an unforgettable twist. It takes place in four countries, two strangers, one target, where truth is illusion and those you love will be the first to go missing. It's available on Amazon and paperback and ebook. Missing by Mia Molson-Zia has garnered great reviews and Eve Levin endorsed by Hollywood celebrities, including Joanna Cassidy, Forbes Riley, and many others. So grab your copy today for Ghost Missing by Mia Molson-Zia, available on Amazon. Also, check out The Mike Wagner Show at themikewagnershow.com and over 40 podcast platforms heard in over 100 countries, including Facebook, SoundCloud, Spreaker, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. Also, Anchor FM, iTunes, Google Play, Amazon, Audible, Apple Music. Also on HamiltonRadio.net, Oldies FM, Diamonds Radio, and a few of the networks coming soon. Take The Mike Wagner Show with you on any mobile device. Subscribe to The Mike Wagner Show on the YouTube channel. Don't forget to follow The Mike Wagner Show on Instagram and Twitter today. And for great gift ideas, go to Amazon.com and check out The Mike Wagner Show podcast. T-shirts, pop sockets, throw pillows, tote bags, and makes... Also, baseball gear makes great gifts 24/7 for family, friends, and loved ones as well, including our special guest, Amazon.com. Check out the Mike Wagner podcast. And for more great gift ideas, go to Amazon.com/Mia Molson-Zia for great books like Missing, Once, and Wrinkles. Also, T-shirts, pop sockets, hoodies, phone cases, and more. Amazon.com/Mia Molson-Zia. Check it out today. I'll support the Mike Wagner Show on Anchor FM, PayPal, themikewagnershow.com. You can buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com at the Mike Wagner Show. Make sure you do so today. We're here with an amazing gentleman from the Boston area, wow, who is engineer, one of the more popular Boston broadcasts as well. He's the author of several books on Boston history, is a lifetime Bostonian, published and produced a playwright as well, too, and a lecturer on a variety of historical subjects. And he was also a playwright on the Case of the Bambino. We'll talk some baseball on that one. He also lectured in Law and Order, also Boston, Great Boston Fires, and Scholarly Square as well. And also he was part of co-producing and co-writing Building Route 128, Presidential Landmarks in New England, also Boston's West End and The Big Dig. And he's got a brand new book talking about the amazing story of the 1962 Alcatraz escape by three inmates in a homemade raft and how they do it. And of course, a movie was also tied to it. We'll talk about that live, ladies and gentlemen, from the Plus Studios in beautiful downtown Boston and part of the Beantown, the amazing multi-talented author of several books and the book Inseparable and Alcatraz Escape Adventure. Ladies and gentlemen, the multi-talented David Crew. David, good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Thanks for joining us today.
Bravo. You did that all sound like you did it all in one breath too. I'm really impressed, Mike. First of all, as I told you in our pre-discussion, thank you for having me. This is my YouTube TV debut, and this is also the first interview I'm doing for the new book. So I really appreciate the opportunity to be here, and nice to chat with you.
And great to have you on board as well, too. And of course, you also engineer for the very popular Mozzie Stafford as well, too. And I'll have to let the cat out of the bag in this one, too. So yeah, a lot of Boston areas as well, too. And of course, I'd love to have a chowder with you one day. So you're author of several.
You're welcome. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yes. And have a little bit of Beantown as well, too. Author of several books on Boston history. Published and produced a playwright, and one of them was The Case of Bambino, lecture on available of historical subjects in the Boston area. Your new book is about the amazing true story of the 1962 Alcatraz escape by three inmates in a homemade raft. And two of the escapees landed on beach near Sausalito and happened to be discovered by an independent 13-year-old boy, and of course, inspired by a movie as well, too. I mean, we love escapes like that, too. But you've tried that in Boston. I don't know what they're going to do about that. But before getting all that, David, tell us how you first got started.
You mean on this particular book?
No, just about you in general, being an author, a playwright, and also an engineer as well, too, and just an amazing career being a lifelong Bostonian. So tell us more about how you got started.
Well, I I hate to have to correct my host, but I'm not a lifelong Bostonian. I moved here in 1981 after attempting my own on-air disc jockey career. Did not go very well. But I came here to Boston in 81 to study engineering at Boston University, working full-time at an AM-FM combo in downtown Boston. That is where I met my wife, who was a disc jockey at the radio station. So as I like to say, one good thing at least came out of my broadcast career, which was now 35 years of marriage. But I'd always enjoyed writing and started writing columns, had stuff published in local papers and then the Boston Globe. And then I came up with this idea for a book about a place called Scholly Square, which was the entertainment district here in Boston. What happened was I moved to Boston in 1981. Go home for Thanksgiving, and an uncle of mine who was a doctor in the U.S. Navy, he corners me in a corner of the living room, and he says, "So I hear you're in Boston," and he's got this leering, salacious look on his face. I said, "Yeah." He goes, "How are things in Scholly Square?" Now, I had just moved to Boston. I'd never heard of the place. And I told him, so I said, I don't know what you're talking about. And the look on the old man's face, this sheer disappointment, it was palpable. And he began to tell me this story. It was the first Scholly Square story I had heard. And it started me on decades of becoming a Boston historian and writer. He tells me how during the war, World War II, the ship would pull into port in Charlestown, which is right across the harbor, as we say in Boston, from the city. And the commanding officer, the ship CO, would get on the intercom and say, "Okay, men, it's liberty time in Boston. You've earned it. But just remember the rules. Rule number one is don't go to Scholly Square." Well, Scholly Square is where the burlesque theaters and the nightclubs and the tattoo parlors and the bars, where all that fun stuff was located. So where do you suppose the first place was that all those thirsty and horny sailors went as soon as that gangplank hit the ground? Boom, they went to Scholly Square.
Too obvious.
Well, so it's 1981, and I was a single man at the time, and I couldn't wait to get back to Boston. And when I do, I find the disappointing news that 20 years earlier, Scholly Square had been razed, torn down to the ground, below the ground, in fact. The subway was rebuilt, and up above where Scholly Square was, they built the new Boston City Hall. And I was just fascinated how a part of a city could completely be wiped off the face of the map. So I began doing some research, started hearing stories, and what I found was this something I found consistent in Boston. It's this beautiful dichotomy. On the one hand, you have the George Washington slept here type of history. We're very proud of that. The Boston Tea Party and Bunker Hill and the Sons of Liberty. And by the way, George Washington did sleep in a part of Scholly Square.
Interesting.
Then there's this other part of Boston. There is the Boston of Charlestown and the Code of Silence, and Southie, and Whitey Bulger, and the North End, and the Angelos. There is the immigrant story of Boston, how first the Irish, and then the Italians, and the Poles, and the Jews, and the Eastern Europeans, and the Southern Europeans came in and had to muscle their way through the Yankees to get their rightful place of power in Boston. Mm-hmm. These two things going on, it was all there in Scholly Square. And the more I researched the square and then started branching out into other parts of the city, I ended up with two books about Scholly Square.
Well, I like and, to see them.
Well, okay, well, let's see. This was the first one. It was called Always Something Doing, which was the tagline or the advertising line for a place called the Old Howard Burlesque Theater, mm-hmm. which had been started in 1845 and was open with the exception of a month in 1930 when it was closed for, quote, indecency by our Watch and Ward Society. but almost consistently for 100 and something years.
Wow.
So this book, mostly words and a few pictures. And then in 2004, another book, which is from the wonderful people at Arcadia. And this is, as a typical Arcadia book, it's mostly pictures. I think there are 180 pictures, many never before published.
Wow.
With stories about Scully Square. And I just want to show you, this is that when I talk about the immigrant story and how pieces of Boston touch every family. In the book is a fellow of this young boxer. That is John Mascretolo. He's my wife's uncle. And
it turns out that
picture was taken at a place called Kelly and Hayes Gym, which is on Hanover Street, which used to go all the way to base of Beacon Hill. And it was right in the middle of Scully Square. And this, he was known as Kid Mosky. And I loved the picture so much, and I knew I had to put it in the book. So those are my two books on the square. But writing, as any writer will tell you, usually doesn't pay the bills. So I was working full time as an engineer, and then I ended up in marketing, working for a high tech company, and did that until and continued to write part time, writing my musical called The Curse of the Bambino, which is all about the Boston Red Sox. We premiered at the Lyric Stage, an Equity Theater in Boston in 2001. Broke box office records. They extended the piece 2 weeks. We got two more productions at a couple of other local theaters. And those darn Red Sox, they had to go and win the World Series in 2004. And no more curse, no more musical.
Oh my gosh. I think that was 2004, wasn't it?
2004.
I remember. I think I was actually waiting for my son to come out and hear about the Red Sox, go on that run. It's like, what's... Red Sox win the World Series. Next thing you know, my friends in Boston are like, when are you coming to Boston to celebrate when the Cubs win the World Series? And here it is 4 years after.
Yeah. And so you mentioned the Cubs. 2003, that was the year of the Bartman ball.
I remember
incident
that.
At Wrigley. And that was the Red Sox, the Aaron Boone home run, seventh game of the playoff with the Yankees. Mm-hmm. But we came this close to a Red Sox Cubs World Series with neither team up to that point having broken their curse. And I used to joke, I said, if they do meet in the World Series, that's the sign of the apocalypse, because whoever wins, one half of the country is just going to be very angry.
I think there was a civil war going on as well too, and you can thank the Cleveland Indians, accomplishing that feat as well too. They haven't won a series since 47, and the big story was Who's gonna win? Who's gonna suffer more? And I remember being at a Buffalo Wild Wings with my family in Bismarck. There was like a handful of Cub fans, and the majority were Cleveland Indian fans, a group of pastors attending a conference. And here we are, staying up till like 1 a.m. And one of them came up and said, "We're gonna pray for your Cubs to go back to back." Says, "No, we're gonna pray for your Indians to win since 1947. Yeah. You guys need more than we do. We're not gonna win from there for 109 years."
And by the way, that the Cleveland Indians got in, and again, I had to correct the host, but it was 1948.
Oh, it was 48. I thought it was 48. For some reason.
So in 1948, Boston came as close as it's ever come to having not a subway series. Up here, we would have called it a trolley series, because the Boston Braves were tied with the Cleveland Indians at the end of the season. And they had a one-game playoff to see who would go to the World Series. And part of the Boston Red Sox curse was that they lost that one-game series, that one-game playoff. Cleveland went on to beat the Braves in the 48 series.
That was it. I kept thinking for 47, maybe somebody was a little biased right there too, but it was somewhere around that range. And I remember Lou Boudreau at the time was playing for the Indians and became a Cub broadcaster, kept hammering 47 in our heads. But of course, one day I'm sure the Red Sox and Cubs would meet one day. If it's a regular series, that's fine too. I'm okay with it. So
yeah, it's funny because the friends I have in Chicago, they're all White Sox fans. So we get to we get to text with each other about 8-9 times a season.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's really interesting too. And Tim Anderson really brought the White Sox in as well too. And it's amazing to hear about Scully Square as well too. And you also talk about Law and Order and also Great mm-hmm. Boston Fires and everything else. And
yeah.
some of the other subjects I'd like to hear about those, but first listen to the Mike Widener Show at the MikeWidenerShow.com, powered by Sonic Web Studios. Visit online at SonicWebStudios.com for all your needs. Looking at a professional website without breaking your budget, Sonic Web Studios is the answer. Sonic Web Studios offers fast, affordable custom web designs that blow the competition away. Call today, 1-800-303-3960. That's 1-800-303-3960. Or email to support at SonicWebStudios.com. Mention the Mike Widener Show, get 20% off your first project. Sonic Web Studios, take your image to the next level. Also, time to give official shout out to our official sponsor of the Mike Widener Show, international warring author Mia Molson-Zia. If you love fast-paced mysteries, you'll love Missing by Mia Molson-Zia, available on Amazon in paperback and ebook. Missing is fast-paced and intriguing with an unforgettable twist. It takes place in 4 countries, 2 strangers, 1 target, where truth is illusion and those you love will be the first to go missing. It's available on Amazon in paperback and ebook. Missing by Mia Molson-Zia has garnered great reviews and Eve 11 endorsed by Howard's lovers, including Joanna Cassidy, Forge Riley, and many others. So grab your copy today for Ghost Missing by Mia Molson-Zia. Available on Amazon. Also, check out the Mike Widener Show at themikewidenershow.com. Over 40 podcast platforms heard in over 100 countries. Take us with you on any mobile device. Subscribe to the Mike Widener Show on the YouTube channel. Follow the Mike Widener Show on Instagram and Twitter today. And for great gift ideas, go to Amazon.com and check out the Mike Widener Show podcast. And for more great gift ideas, go to Amazon.com/Mia Molson-Zia for great books, merchandise, and more. Also, support the Mike Widener Show on Anchor FM, PayPal, themikewidenershow.com. Buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com at the Mike Widener Show. Make sure you do so today. We're here with the amazing, multi-talented David Crewe here on the Mike Widener Show. And of course, you come into Boston from 1981. You talk about several books on Boston history and mm-hmm. also The Curse of Bambino. You also lectured on Law and Order in Boston, mm-hmm. Great Boston Fires and the Scully Square. It feels to me that you're like been living in Boston all your life. It just felt like and just truly amazing. And some intrigue as well too, like the Great Boston Fires, Law and mm-hmm. Order, and of course,
yeah,
leading up to Alcatraz, and maybe a little bit about some of the Boston things that's going on too. Even Whitey Bulger, I read about that. Amazing.
Well, so there's an interesting Whitey Bulger connection to the Alcatraz escape. So June 22nd, 2011, Whitey Bulger, who had been on the lam after an FBI agent, a rogue FBI agent, tipped him off that he was about to be arrested, they finally captured Whitey in Santa Monica, California. It just so happened that my family and I were vacationing in San Francisco. Wow. And we had come back that day from where? From touring Alcatraz, which, by the way, is the number one paid tourist attraction in San Francisco, and for good reason. I cannot recommend it more highly. The National Park Service has done an amazing job of making this wonderful immersive experience. You put on headphones and you hear the sound of the inmates and the guards and the doors clanging shut, and you really feel like you experience what it's like as you walk down these blocks of cells. Well, we had returned to our hotel, and as I'm passing the bar, I see a TV news program, and the chyron at the bottom says, Whitey Bulger captured. Well, I quickly go into the bar. I'm watching this, and the first thing I had to do was to call a friend of mine who lives in Southie, my friend Marty, and I just said, and we just, we were just, I was beside myself, he was beside himself, and we started joking, well, let's see how long Whitey lasts in lockup after what he's done. So here's the connection. This past Saturday night is the 60th anniversary of the night that Frank Morris, John Anglin, and Clarence Anglin escaped from Alcatraz in a homemade raft. There was supposed to be a fourth inmate on that raft with them, a fellow named Alan West, for reasons that are actually shown in that terrific Clint Eastwood movie, which, by the way, is pretty darn accurate as to what actually happened that before they escaped. Mm-hmm. But West couldn't make it out of his cell. So the next morning, when the guards do their morning check and they find Morris, Anglin, and Anglin are missing, but they see Alan West and they see the fake heads that they had he had made, which obviously he didn't need. They found the vent, which was supposed to let him into the corridor. It was displaced. So they make him a deal. They say, if you tell us everything you know, we won't extend your sentence. So West is more than happy. He figures, what the hell? These three guys, they're gone. There's nothing I can say that's going to hurt them. So he sings like a bird. Well, Whitey Bulger was in the prison at the time. He was an inmate at Alcatraz on June 11th, 1962. And I always thought it would be great, and I end up putting it in the novel. I just think it's great that Whitey Bulger, the consummate rat, would, in my novel, get to make his own assessment of Alan West being a rat for telling the authorities everything that he knew about the escape. Mm-hmm. But it's very cool to think that Whitey was there at the time. So when and this is something I knew only after beginning my research for the book, but there's my own Whitey connection, if you will, to Alcatraz.
Yeah, that's rather interesting. And I was just thinking about, you know, I saw that movie, what was it, 72 or 73, Escape from
1979.
Alcatraz. It was 79, okay.
Directed by Don Siegel, who also directed the Dirty Harry movies. So he and Don Siegel did a lot of movies in San Francisco, so he was well familiar with the area. And it's a terrific film. And there is a scene, as a matter of fact, they filmed some of the movie at Alcatraz. Notably, there were several scenes in the exercise yard. Mm. So when we went to Alcatraz, we took the tour, we go into the exercise yard, and if you've seen the movie, you remember there was a great scene where there was a black inmate who kind of ran, you know, his part of the population, and he challenges Clint Eastwood to sit next to him, which he does. And he walks up these steps and they sit there and they look out on the bay. So, of course, like every other tourist, I had to sit where Clint Eastwood sat, you know, and I'm sitting there and I'm looking in the distance. And there's the Golden Gate Bridge.
Wow.
And the tour guides had said something to us like how on certain nights, if the wind was just right, the sounds of San Francisco, traffic, music, women laughing, would float across the bay and into the cells of these prisoners. And you can imagine how that would have driven them crazy. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking about that, about these men in their cells. I'm looking at the Golden Gate Bridge. And my daughter, who had just turned into a teenager, and anybody who has a teenager or knows a teenager knows how they tend to strain at the leash. You know, they're independent. They're trying to find their own space. And that was the moment which I had this idea, wouldn't it be fun if they made it? You know, I looked across the bay, and there's a town called Sausalito, mm-hmm. which is just north of San Francisco, across the Golden Gate Bridge. What if a teenager, like my daughter, found those inmates barely alive on a beach and, for reasons that are explained in the book, decides to help them to freedom? And that's the novel. That's the adventure that begins. I made it a teenage boy because I could write better, having been a teenage boy myself.
I think many of us have. So yeah, even so, raising them too.
So, right. Oh, there you go. So, his the how they spend the next few days evading the Coast Guard, the FBI, the local police, the media, and the boy's mother to try to help two of the escapees, the Anglin brothers, to freedom. And that's the basic plot of the novel Inseparable, and that's where the idea came from.
That's one of the interesting, too, and I was reading about some of it as well, too, you know, just like Escape from Alcatraz, and of course, you think that mm-hmm. the boy was independent, and also growing up without a dad, technically, mm-hmm. mom single, and everything else, and I guess you kind of think it's like, you know, what kind of actually drove him to help those three men?
Well, don't want to give too much away, Mike, because I want people to read the book. But a lot of what I built in the boy and in his mother comes directly from the actual events. That's being a historian. I spent a few months before even beginning to write the novel researching Sausalito, researching, and I found some very interesting things, like during World War II, they built a shipyard, literally from scratch. Within 6 months, they went from this muddy inlet to this shipyard that was the most productive of all the shipyards in the country. Wow. They produced Liberty ships and tankers and LSVs, and to build them, they needed welders. But most of the welders, the young men, well, they were off fighting the war. So they advertised around the country for women to come to Sausalito. They would be provided housing. They would be trained to weld these Liberty ships and tankers and LSVs. And they came from all over. They came from small towns in Kansas and Minnesota and Tennessee looking for opportunities. And one of those, I created a character who is one of those women based on a real country girl who came to Sausalito, learned to weld, and turned out to be very, very good at it, and also turned out to be very artistic. And so after the war, when she was done welding ships for the for America, she started welding sculptures and became quite good and quite successful as a sculptress. Nice. And that's what the boy's mother, whose husband gets killed in Korea at a place called the Punch Bowl. Look it up. It was a pretty horrific battle. Mm. And so the boy grows up without a father, but an independent mother in a town which, I got to say, if you know, I loved where I grew up, a town on Long Island in New York. But if I could choose a place to grow up, I think I would choose Sausalito. It was artistic. It's where people like Sterling Hayden, the actor, he spoke glowingly. He wrote a book called Wanderer, and he talks about Sausalito being this bayside community with fishermen and this independent artistic spirit in these houseboats, that many of which came from leftover ships and from all the construction that was done during the war. So from the late 1940s through the 1950s and the early 60s, there was a vibrant artistic houseboat community. Sculptors, people like Allen Ginsberg, Jack Kerouac, artists and musicians. You've all heard the song "Sitting on the Dock of the Bay." Well, Otis Redding was sitting on the dock of Sausalito.
How do you like at the that? Bay.
Yeah. So, so the idea of this, what I love about this town, this creativity, and these streaks of independence, of thinking outside the box. You know, the '60s wouldn't have happened without the '50s, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's what I built into the characters. And I you know, thank you, Sausalito, for having such an amazing community that really nurtured. That is until the 60s, the later 60s, when developers, they started eyeing those houseboats in that area. And so began the Battle of the Houseboats. And maybe that's another novel someday, but that
that'd be a good idea.
It got pretty bad for a while as people battled, you know, not to be too dramatic, but for the soul of this town. But that takes place after 1962 and the events of the book. But it really helped inspire me to build and to come up with a realistic reason why a 13-year-old boy would help these two escapees.
And that's rather interesting too, in being a homemade raft as well too. And according to record, I'm just paraphrasing it, it seemed like they're the only ones that actually escaped safely, Mount Contreras, and the others tried, and it's just like they perished. It's like that was like the most heroic and probably the only ones that actually did escape before they shut it down.
Well, so the reason they did it in a raft was because the water of San Francisco Bay at that time of year, in fact, most of the year, it doesn't get much higher than the low 60s.
Wow.
Hypothermia can set in within a couple of hours and death is almost guaranteed within 6 to 12. So you want to be above the water. Those inmates who tried to swim were either shot or they gave up or they were picked up by a boat. There was one case of an inmate who actually did make it all the way to the base of the Golden Gate Bridge. But he was so exhausted. And this was 6 months after our three inmates went out in their raft. This inmate, by the time he made it to San Francisco, was so exhausted. He literally could not move. Some teenage boys found him lying on the beach. They called their parents, who called the police, and he was easily picked up. But that's the only case I know of a successful swim by an inmate from Alcatraz. But let me tell you, in 1934, when the federal government announced that what had to that point been a federal military prison would be turned into a federal penitentiary, there was a great hue and cry by a portion of the population. They did not want a prison, even though, well, the federal authorities assure you, who could possibly escape from this island in the middle of this cold bay? Well, a team of female competitive swimmers got in the water at Alcatraz Island and swam to San Francisco. And then they swam back.
Oh my goodness.
Shot. So, and so you can imagine, well, there's your proof that it's not really inescapable, is it? Well, they said, well, these were trained athletes. And I suppose is a fair enough point. The other point being, something that the wardens of Alcatraz did, the showers at Alcatraz, they were hot. There was hot water in those showers and you couldn't adjust the temperature. So there was no way for the inmates to get acclimated to cold water and perhaps help their endurance.
That's really interesting too. And how about some of the other things that people don't know about Alcatraz, like say with, of course, I remember that I think in one of the prisons, this is like a little off topic with Alcatraz, another federal prison like Al Capone. You know, he got his own special jail cell, you know, a really big jail cell, his own AM stereo radio and room service and, you know, nice luxury and everything. Or maybe like, you know, who are some of the other prisoners that got like the real special treatment, like say AM radios or catered service, like the biggest among there. So.
Well, if you go to Alcatraz, you can see Mr. Capone's cell, and it really wasn't luxurious. I think when he was at an Illinois prison, he might have had a little better treatment, but it wasn't like Goodfellas, where, you know, Paul Sorvino is getting the wine and making the meatballs, and he and Ray Liotta are making spaghetti sauce. No, he was in a traditional cell. There really was no special treatment, and Al was slowly dying of a social disease, as they used to call it. So he really wasn't in his right mind to enjoy much of those luxuries either.
Mm-hmm. And of course, too, that, you know, one thing about Alcatraz as well, too, when it, you know, closed and everything else, and, mm-hmm. you know, being a prisoner as well, too. And of course, you of course got your penitentiary as well. Do you think they would pull the same, like, say, if it was in Boston, Chicago, or maybe Long Island or anything like that?
Well, so here's the thing about Alcatraz being in the middle of San Francisco Bay, which is a body of salt water. Salt is highly corrosive. So all of that steel rebar and concrete began to deteriorate. It was costing a lot of money to maintain Alcatraz. It costs a lot of money to keep the guards and the warden and other personnel living on the island, supporting them with food and other items. And the place was literally falling apart. The escape of these three men in June of 1962 really accelerated the inevitable. Alcatraz was due to close anyway, which it did about a year later. And this is a quote I actually get to use in the book, even though mine is a novel. There's a great quote from, and I'm blanking on the name of the inmate, but he was the last inmate to walk off Alcatraz Island. And he was stopped by a reporter who said, you know, what do you have to say now that the prison, that you're the last prisoner at Alcatraz? And it's a great quote. He just says, Alcatraz wasn't no good for nobody. And they put him on the launch and they took him away, and Alcatraz closed, you know. Mm. And then, of course, you know, it had its own very interesting post-prison story with the takeover from the Native Americans wasn't a year or two they were out there. So, you know, it's got a very interesting and storied history. Mm. Above and beyond just the escape of these three men.
Mm-hmm. And that's very interesting as well, too. Where can we find Inseparable Rat and some of your other works at, David?
Well, you can find it on Amazon, or if you go to if you go to the website for the book, which is inseparablealcatraznovel.com. It's all one word. Maybe you can chyron it in post-production, inseparablealcatraznovel.com. The book is 30% off until the end of the month. We officially release on June 21st. And it's very exciting because after having a number of nonfiction books published, this is my first published novel.
That's certainly amazing as well, too, and looking forward to it. And what's coming up for David Crew and more, we'll find out in just 1 minute. You listen to The Mike Widener Show at themikewidenershow.com, powered by SonicWeb Studios. Visit online at sonicwebstudios.com for all your needs. Also brought to you by our official sponsor, The Mike Widener Show, international warring author Mia Molson's The Missing, available on Amazon, paperback, and ebook. We'll be back with author David Crew of Inseparable and Alcatraz Escape Adventure after this time out. We're back with author David Crew on The Mike Widener Show with Inseparable and Alcatraz Escape Adventure as well, too. And, you know, great, great conversation about the book and everything. Learned about Alcatraz and, you know, living in Boston since 1981. And speaking of that, what else can we expect from you in 2022 and beyond, David?
What I'm working on now is a Boston mystery. So I'm going back to nonfiction. Take you back to August 15th, 1945. That's the day that Japan surrendered or announced that it would surrender to the United States, and the war was over. So Boston, like every other place in America, just erupted in this amazing celebration. Impromptu conga lines and people tearing up phone books and making ticker tape parades and sailors and soldiers and Marines kissing pretty girls, and everyone's going crazy in the midst of all this celebration. A young woman with a baby in her arms walks up to a 16-year-old newsboy on the Boston Common, and she says, "Would you please watch my baby? I need to go and take care of something. Here's $2 for your trouble." He takes the $2, he takes the baby, and the woman disappears into the crowd, and she doesn't return.
Oh my gosh.
Now, the baby starts to cry. There are these three girls from Dorchester. They see this improbable, weird sight of a 16-year-old newsboy holding a baby. They go over, they get a policeman. The baby is taken to a police station, and eventually he enters the care of the state. He becomes a ward of the state. Hmm. He goes into foster care. He is adopted by a wonderful family, John and Dorothy Garvey. They raise the boy, and he grows to manhood, and he gets married, and he has a couple of children. Flash forward to 2005, I wrote a story in the Boston Globe about this abandoned baby. And the daughter of this baby, who was nicknamed Little Baby Victory by the press,
mm-hmm.
the daughter gets in touch with me.
Huh.
Her name is Tina. She herself got married. She's got a couple of kids. She's living out in Chicago now. And she said, I pick up the phone. She says, my name is Tima Drezo. She says, "My father was Robert Garvey. My father was Baby Victory."
Wow.
Yeah. So a lot of tears, because I couldn't believe I'm talking to the baby's daughter, if you will. And we've become great friends, and we've talked a lot about it. And we decided that we're going to write a book. She's done the DNA testing through a couple of the services. I've been doing research, finding in the papers the story and whether or not there are any clues in the newspaper articles. We think it's going to be more of a story about the journey, about the journey from this baby ending up in this boy's arms, and his travel and journey through the foster care system, through adoption. And, you know, it's a remarkable family story. Her grandfather, her adopted grandfather, was a CB in the Pacific. He ends up going into business with a fellow who fought in the European theater. The two of them start a restaurant that allows them to be able to afford to adopt this baby. There's just so many aspects to this story, and we're really just kind of scratching the surface right now, peeling the onion. Any more cliches I can come up with,
mm-hmm.
but it's absolutely fascinating. And it's going back now to my roots, to, you know, doing research of actual historical events, historical people, but now it's kind of become kind of personal as I talk to the children of those three Dorchester girls who saw the baby in the newsboy's arms, or the nurses who got their pictures on the front pages of Boston papers, and now I'm talking to their nieces and their grandchildren, saying, "Did you know your mother or your grandmother or your aunt was part of this interesting story?" So building stories about Bostonians and their lives and how they intersected with this child. So, the outside chance that maybe somehow, some way, we'll actually find out the identity of that woman.
So, oh my
Tina
gosh.
Can get to know her real grandmother.
I'm so fascinated by this, and we'll definitely have you on about that as we go on here. And who do you consider biggest influence in career, David?
I mean, as you can see, I do a lot of reading. I suppose, David McCullough comes immediately to mind, Doris Kearns Goodwin, Stephen Ambrose, just terrific historians, great writers. My favorite author is Pete Hamill and Ray Bradbury.
Oh,
but,
yes.
You know, they're up here and I'm kind of sitting down.
You'll
here.
Get there one day.
Well,
you'll
they are,
they,
you know, obviously, if you're going to shoot, you might as well shoot for the moon. They'd be two of my favorites in terms of both fiction and, in Pete Hamill's case, he was a terrific, terrific columnist, but one of my favorite novels called Snow in August. And big shoes or, keyboard to fill.
And certainly looking forward to, you got good something going. And what's the best advice you can give to anybody at this point?
You mean writers?
Just anything in general.
Well, I'll give you a method. I just wrote, I added to that, to a blog that on that, my website, the Inseparable Alcatraz novel website, that's .com, inseparablealcatraznovel.com. If you're a writer or you want to be a writer, write. Just sit down every damn day and get used to taking ideas from up here and getting them down on the keyboard. There really is muscle memory involved. It's the discipline. It's feeling as that it's as natural as breathing to sit down and to take your ideas and to write them. And I'll pass along secondhand the best advice that Stephen King ever gave. And it's the only Stephen King book I've ever read, actually. It's a book called On Writing. Terrific book. It was very inspirational. And in the book, he wrote the following. He said, write your first draft with the door closed and your second draft with the door open.
Huh, how you like that?
I love that. And so if you're thinking of writing, go ahead, write. But don't worry about it. Keep that door shut and write it, put it aside, come back to it, manipulate it, massage it, edit it, maybe give it to somebody that you can trust who's going to give you honest, and then open the door and then let people read it. And so through Mr. King, I give you that advice. And for myself, I just say, but you just sit down and write, just do it.
Oh my gosh. That's great advice. I have to tell my wife that she's a writer. I got some friends. That's amazing advice. I love it. Yes. I'll let you and Stephen know as well too. We're here with author David Crew of Inseparable and Alcatraz Escape Adventure on the Mike Wagner Show. David, a very big thank you for your time. You've been absolutely fantastic. Learned a lot from you. Looking forward to having you soon. Make sure you keep us up to date. Keep in touch. Love to have you back. And once again, tell us about your upcoming projects. What's your website? How do people contact? Where can people purchase or check out your book?
InseparableAlcatrazNovel.com. It's all one word. I thank you, Mike, so much. And again, I'm delighted. My first interview for the novel and my first appearance on YouTube TV. This has been a lot of fun. You're a lot of fun. And I wish you success with your show.
And you too as well. I'd like to wish you all the best. Looking forward to having you in soon. Just keep us up to date. Keep in touch. Love to have you back. And definitely have a great future. Have you, David.
Thank you so much.